Welcome to Sports Coach Radio. Creatine. It's the go-to nutrition supplement for almost every high-performance athlete. But how much do you really know about it? Dr. Rick Kreider is the director of the Exercise and Sport Nutrition Lab at Texas A&M University, one of the world's leading experts on creatine and other sports nutrition supplements. Rick is also the founding editor-in-chief of the Journal of the International Society of Sports Nutrition. I'm Glenn Whitney, a sports and leadership psychologist and host of SportsCoachRadio.com. You can subscribe to us on Apple iTunes and follow us on Twitter via the handle @SportsCoachTalk. And if you have a moment, we'd appreciate it if you could leave a short review on the Apple iTunes site. Your review will help other people find out about the show. Rick has a very clear and sensible way of talking about sports science. This interview should be of interest to even the least nutrition-focused coaches and athletes. He's also the co-author of Exercise and Sport Nutrition, Principles, Promises, Science, and Recommendations, as well as Overtraining in Sports. After you listen to the interview, the website www.exerciseandsportnutritionlab.com is a great place to get more detailed information. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
I was hoping you could start off by explaining how you got interested in creatine and why it's particularly an important part of your research interests and basically what attracts you to the topic.
Sure. We got interested in doing research on performance enhancement in the late 80s when I was a faculty member at Old Dominion University. I had the privilege of working with a person named Mel Williams, who's really the grandfather of ergogenic aids in sport nutrition. And so we were interested in various nutrients that can help improve performance or help training adaptations in the early 90s. And we got contacted by a group that was just launching and bringing creatine into the U.S. market, a guy named Anthony Almada, who was one of the co-founders of EAS, which is a popular sport nutrition company now. And he sent me a lot of literature from Europe coming out of England, and it showed some effects on muscle changes in creatine and potential exercise improvement or ergogenic improvement capacity. And so we actually started doing research on creatine in 1994. And we've probably done 10, 15 studies, short-term and long-term studies, over the years. Wrote a book in 98 on creatine. So our interest was just purely to see if there's any benefit to creatine, or do the benefits match up with some of the initial research and some of the marketing claims.
And how has the use of it among athletes been evolving since, I guess, the mid-90s?
It really started in Europe and actually in England around probably 91 through 92 or so, before the 92 Olympics. Christopher Langford, one of the 100-meter sprinters in England, actually started it and kind of was an initial really popular athlete taking it back then. But actually, creatine has been around for a long time, and people actually have been taking it as a dietary supplement for health benefits since the 70s, actually. But for performance, it really took off in the early 90s, probably 93, 94. And the individual I mentioned, Anthony Almada, was one of the first groups to be able to bring it to the United States and actually start putting it on the market as a potential supplement for athletes.
So where are we now, if I can ask you a difficult question or a challenge, to describe to coaches, elite coaches, in 2 or 3 minutes, why they should care about creatine?
Well, there's only a handful of supplements or nutritional strategies that really can make a big impact on performance. And creatine's now been extensively studied since the early 90s and has repeatedly been shown to improve high-intensity exercise performance and training adaptations, leading to things like greater muscle mass, muscle power, endurance during repeated high-intensity sprints. So most athletic events involve explosive, powerful movement in the recovery. And so for individuals involved sprinting or things like basketball or football, there's a lot of explosive activity. Creatine can help increase energy stores in the muscle and thereby allow you to sprint faster, longer, and recover quicker between intense bouts. So for a coach, the really take-home is that this is one of a very few supplements where the research really supports the efficacy as well as safety So it can be in the arsenal of a coach, just like good diet and good training techniques is one thing that can help improve performance.
Well, let's cover endurance events later, or endurance sports later, and take a look at, the sort of full range. I'm thinking from maybe golf to something like soccer. Are you saying that creatine is useful for athletes across that spectrum?
Yes. Initially, most of the research was on explosive power, short sprints. For example, one of our initial studies was kind of simulating a 12-play drive in football, 6-second sprints, 30 seconds recovery, kind of like a simulated drive. And so a lot of the studies have initially focused on that, but now there's been a number of studies actually looking at intermittent soccer, endurance, even applications for high-end endurance athletes, because the more we've learned about what creatine can do, there are advantages even for the endurance athlete that might be interested in taking creatine.
So in terms of intensity, it's pretty much, if you're thinking about Olympic sports, almost across the board, every single sport we can imagine, apart from, say, archery and shooting. I guess it's not useful for that.
Archery, we actually have very high-level archery here. Some of the Olympic coaches are at Texas A&M. Have been with the coaches, but it requires a lot of strength in the upper body and the ability to maintain that strength for 20, 30 seconds while they're really focusing and aiming on, and repeat it over time. So even those type of sports where there's some training adaptations, you got to be strong, you got to be able to maintain the muscle contraction even those events could have some benefit. Creatine is kind of like, if you think of an analogy, many people know what carbohydrate loading is, where an endurance athlete eats lots of extra carbohydrates, spaghetti things before a big race, and it stores more carbohydrate in the muscle in the form of muscle glycogen. It's like adding more gas, a bigger gas tank, basically, so you can exercise longer before fatigue. Creatine is much like that. The normal body has about two-thirds capacity of a fuel tank of creatine in the form of fossil creatine. And in your normal diet, you typically maintain about two-thirds full of gas for this creatine, and it's used for very high-intense explosive exercise. By adding more creatine in the diet, you can get your fuel tank up towards 100%. And the value of that is that when you're doing repeated sprints over and over again, or during an intense training period like weightlifting where you're doing sets and recovery and sets of recovery, you're able to do more higher quality work, which leads to greater training adaptations, which leads to better performance over time. And if you're doing that short sprint recovery, a swimmer or somebody that's got 30 seconds, 60 second sprints, or even a track athlete, they're able to recover between those sets, between those rest periods a little quicker, so that the quality of the work over a series of repetitions or a series of sprints is improved and the performance is increased. So basically you're trying to add creatine in a diet to therefore add more energy in a muscle to fill up that gas tank so that you can perform high-intensity exercise to a greater degree.
And so what percentage, I know this is a difficult question, but what percentage of the top three, the podium finishers in Olympics, for example, across the board would be probably taking creatine? I'm guessing it's going to be a really high number.
It should be. If you have an athlete that needs to carbo load, creatine is as important for a power athlete as carbohydrate loading is for an endurance athlete. It even has some advantages for an endurance athlete. Back in 1996, a colleague of mine, Dr. Bill Kramer, is at University of Connecticut now, was in USA Today and was talking about all this creatine, what is it, and one of his comments that I often quote is that 80% of the athletes at the 96 Olympics were taking creatine, and the other 20% just didn't know what they were doing. It's because it's that important as a fuel source for the muscle for high-intensity exercise. And you can get creatine in the diet or in dietary supplements very inexpensively to increase the muscle stores. So it's like carbohydrate loading, but for the power athlete.
So apart from being misinformed, are there any good reasons for some athletes to decline to take it? What might be the reasoning for them not consuming creatine?
Yeah, there's a couple of things to consider. First of all, most studies show that it increases muscle power, muscle strength, and leads to more muscle mass. And we now know it's not just weight gain, not just water, which you often read about in the popular press or in advertisements or about supplements. It actually increases muscle mass and myosin, the protein content in muscle. And so if you're a athlete that has weight-dependent sports, say a wrestler or somebody that has to jump, you know, you have to determine if the improvement in power offsets the increase in muscle mass. Now, not all athletes, especially women, don't necessarily gain a lot of weight with creatine, but if you're involved in heavy resistance training, you can typically see a 5 to 10 pound increase in muscle mass during an 8 or 12-week training period. And so in some events, that may not be advantageous. There may be some positions in football, for example. We worked a lot with athletes and football players initially, and it was great for athletes that needed a little gain, a little weight. But then there are some that got so they got strong enough and big enough for the position, and they didn't really need to get any bigger. And so you might back off a little bit at that point.
Because getting bigger would slow them down, presumably.
Well, you know, that's kind of a myth with coaches. You know, if you get too much weight, you know, slow down. Muscle moves. Okay, so if you're more powerful and you're leaner, you should be faster. And so what our recommendation is to coaches is that, yeah, you know, I know you have your prototypical size for linebackers and defensive backs and those type of things, but the reality is if they're able to move and they're moving faster, the more mass they have is actually the better for the athlete because they'll be able to have a greater impact, greater load when they deliver a blow, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if it slows them down, then they're getting too much weight. But if they're getting faster or still as fast, we actually recommend to put as much muscle mass on as possible for many of these type of athletes.
So is all the weight that is gained typically with creatine supplementation, is that all lean muscle mass weight?
Well, it's been a big question in the research. Initially, the thought was, boy, the gain of muscle is fairly quick. You know, and we're measuring with X-ray techniques and muscle biopsies to measure fiber diameter and myosin heavy chain protein content in muscle. The initial studies basically were weight and some body composition measurements. So a lot of initial research, boy, this is awful rapid. You know, week, 3-4 weeks, we're seeing, you know, 1 kg, you know, 2 pound increase in muscle. Maybe it's just water. And well, it kind of makes some sense because muscle is 80% water. So if you gain, you know, 10 pounds of muscle, 8 pounds of that's going to be fluid, right? So, but as the studies then went on and we looked at training and the quality of training, we were able to identify that these are real muscle protein increases in mass, and it's associated with greater power and force and those type of things. So, you know, you're going to gain some fluid because muscle is fluid, a good proportion of it, but this appears to be the weight gain is proportional to a muscle gain or a hypertrophy that would occur as you would want it to occur with normal training.
I'm almost scared to ask this question because the answer might be too technical for me to understand. But how do you differentiate between fluid weight or water weight that's gained as a part of muscle gaining
right.
muscle versus pure water weight or what we would consider non-lean weight?
Well, it depends on how you measure body composition. For example, when we measure body composition in these studies, we actually measure body water. And there's a certain analyzer that can measure total body water, intracellular water, extracellular water. So we can see shifts of fluid and total volume of water. And then we use X-ray method to measure the fat-free mass. So by increasing weight with your water staying proportional to the weight gain, you know it's a proportional increase. If you gained weight and it all was water and there was no muscle mass, then you would understand it's probably more fluid. And then they've been able to corroborate that by doing muscle biopsies and actually measure the fiber diameter changes that occur before and after creatine and training and the protein content of the fibers to corroborate, hey, this is really protein changes. And there have been a number of studies that tried to look at, well, does it stimulate protein synthesis? Does it affect cell replication and these different things? And there's even evidence that some the studies show that there's an increase in protein development in response to the training and the creatine supplementation. So, you know, now the data is pretty clear that it's a real muscle gain. It's not just a water gain. And so that's associated with greater strength and power in the studies as well.
So that's, I take it that's kind of a myth now that if you take creatine, you should be willing to accept some undesirable weight gain. That's not correct.
Correct. There's a lot of myths out there, and things like, well, you need to drink extra water. You know, well, we now know that actually, if you take creatine, if anything, there's just like hyperhydration, a little bit more fluid retention. It actually helps reduce thermal stress during exercise, what the studies show, and reduce cramping. All these things you often hear, see, and read about in the popular media that the research actually shows there's no evidence to. And studies actually try to say, all right, is there really a problem here? And none of them are able to show it. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot of myths about creatine, unfortunately. In part, they're perpetuated by companies trying to sell different forms of creatine, and then say, hey, ours works better, R doesn't cause any side effects, when no studies ever showed any side effect. And it's been used now in athletes, even in special medical populations, who have been found to have some benefit as well.
Well, so I guess I have to ask you that question now. What is the ultimate form of creatine, or I know you're not going to answer this, but you know, the type or the brand of creatine that everybody should be rushing out to buy?
Well, the one that's been studied extensively in the literature is called creatine monohydrate. Okay, there's lots of other forms. There's effervescent, and there's, you know, buffer, and all these different things out there. They all claim to work better, but the creatine monohydrate powder is still by far the best, even when compared to other different forms out there that claim to be better. We've done several of those studies, head-to-head comparison on muscle creatine retention, on performance, all those type of things. And creatine monohydrate still is the best. And there's different forms of creatine monohydrate. The best source is from Germany, and it has usually a label associated called Crea Pure, and it comes from a company called Allschem, and that's all they do with this one particular plant is make creatine for dietary supplements and applications for that. So it's a very pure, it's a very clean process. There's no contaminants and things. So we recommend folks look for the European German creatine as the best source. And if they look for a Crea Pure label on a lot of the dietary supplements, they'll know if it's from Germany.
And can you say the name of that company again?
It's called Allschem, and it's Crea Pure.
Okay.
It's a little label that you'll see on some of the dietary supplements. There's also sources from China and things, and some of the reports and data suggest there might be a little bit more contaminants. We don't know if that's harmful, but we've always studied the German, and we feel that's probably the best source to use.
Now, you said powder. Does that exclude capsules or tablets or something?
Very good question, and this is where a lot of the companies try to one-up each other type thing. The powder is what's been studied most, and if you put that in capsules, or we've even studied gels and things like that, works fine. The problem is when you put creatine into the liquid, it's not real stable for a long period of time, so the shelf life is not very good. For example, you put creatine in a liquid bottle or something like that. And so there's lots of different companies trying to get a liquid form, and I'm still not convinced that any of those, and all the initial studies show it doesn't work as well. And so the powdered form is probably the best. You just take a teaspoon once a day, once you've loaded up with creatine, and that will keep the creatine stores up to be.
And you take that teaspoon of powder and mix it with juice, or what would you consume it with?
Another good study. Initial studies mixed it with teas. Mm-hmm. Well, hot liquids, coffees, and things. And then there were studies showing if you add creatine to a carbohydrate drink, for example, it's got a little bit of sugar in it. Between, you know, initial studies were like 100 grams of sugar, real sugary. We now know one of our studies, you only need about 18, 20 grams of sugar. But if you add it with a juice or some type of sugar drink, that helps the absorption of creatine. You take it four times a day for the first 5 or 6 days. And then one dose a day we usually recommend after exercise, because that's when we want carbs and we want to get some protein in the body, and that makes sense to get it all there together.
Now, I haven't seen at Starbucks that they offer to throw in a teaspoon of creatine into your latte. I mean, that could be a good idea, no? A little money spinner?
I have seen some juice bars, though, especially at the airport, where you can add protein, and I've even seen adding some creatine to your kind of a smoothie shake that you can get.
Okay, so
that's
really interesting. Now, what about, for lack of a better word, natural sources of creatine. You know, it obviously originates from animals, right?
Right.
From meat.
Right. The best sources of creatine from naturally derived foods comes from fish, things like salmon, and red meats. And so, for example, in a pound of salmon, if you can eat a pound, it's probably about 2, maybe 3 grams of creatine in that meat. About 1 to 3 grams in a pound of red meat or a type of thing. So there are some societies, for example, Eskimos, that have a high amount of fish in their diet, have very high chronic creatine content in their diet. Most people, though, only get about 1 gram or so of creatine in their diet per day, and the body actually makes creatine itself from some amino acids, and what it usually does is make about, on average, around 2 grams per, you know, a gram a day plus your diet. So you're getting about 2 grams to keep your turnover. You actually break down some creatine daily. And that's enough to keep that tank about two-thirds, three-fourths full. So by adding a little bit extra dietary sources of creatine, either eating some more meats or taking a dietary supplement where you get, you know, 1 teaspoon, 5 grams, that's enough to add the creatine to the diet and then maintain high levels of creatine in the muscle.
So do you think the kind of elite high-performance athletes we're talking about could get enough creatine from a kind of high-performance natural diet?
Well, it's for example, we know that vegetarians, for example, if you don't have a lot of meat in your diet, you have lower natural occurring creatine in the muscle. So it's probably more important for those that don't eat a lot of meat or fish. If you have athletes that have a very high amount of food coming from meat and fish per day, I mean, you're going to eat probably 1 to 2 pounds of meat per day to get enough creatine really to maintain your creatine store. So you have to think, do I want all those calories? Because, you know, yeah, you get the creatine, but you've also got, you know, a pound of meat, so a lot of calories, and may not all be protein either. So you have to kind of have a trade-off. So most folks that are interested in increasing creatine will take a dietary supplement, add a teaspoon or so a day to a drink, and that's enough to keep their muscle stores up.
And what
most
type
athletes
of...
do that.
Sorry.
Most athletes do it because one of the challenges of athletes is having enough time to eat, their travel schedules, all that. And so, you know, and the other thing is, do you want to get all those calories in the form of fish or meat per day? So you have to kind of balance all that out. I think you would probably need to load on creatine with a supplement, and if you had a very high diet of lots of meats and things, then you probably could maintain your creatine levels that way, but it would require a lot of intake of meat and protein per day to do it.
And on that salmon, what type of salmon has been studied?
I don't know that they've done specific types. You know, there's some of the literature that actually has a table. We had this in our book, for example, that... You know, from the literature, there's a group that actually found the creatine content in various common foods. And so generally, you know, salmon, things like that, herring, things like that are a little bit higher. Red meats are pretty good, you know, 1 to 3 grams per pound or per kg. I can't remember which it was. But it's, again, you have to have a lot of meat to get that much creatine in your diet.
But we're not sure whether we're talking about, say, canned salmon versus... fresh, wild, caught salmon?
Yeah, I don't know that there's much. I mean, we know there's more creatine content typically in red meats versus white meats.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be something. You know, for example, you have some creatine content in turkey, but not much in salmon.
Because I can imagine that some fanatics would decide, you know, natural food fanatics would start eating salmon once a day, every day, or more. Is that not a good idea?
Well, again, you have to balance calories. You know, there's certainly good things. That's a leaner source of meat. There's a lot of good negative essential fatty acids in those type of things. So maybe there's some benefit, but then, you know, do you want all the calories? Do you want all the fat, things that come with meat? So, you know, it's about balance. It's about, you know, making sure your diet has what it needs.
And you mentioned vegetarians. What is your experience generally, not just with creatine, but across the board? You know, in the general population, it seems to be increasing as a eating style preference.
Right.
But particularly for elite athletes, what's your take on vegetarianism?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult for a high-level elite athlete to be a vegetarian. Some people will try and feel that they're healthier, but it's very difficult to get enough quality protein in the diet and have enough varied sources of food in the diet to get all the essential amino acids you need on a vegetarian diet. And so what we will often do is try to negotiate with the individual, say, you know, are you willing to have soy protein powder or something to add to make sure you're getting all the essential amino acids? Or are you willing to take some protein, maybe whey protein? Or, you know, what type of vegetarian are you, willing to be to have eggs and dairy or things like that versus red meat and things? So it takes a lot of nutritional counseling, particularly I would recommend a dietitian to talk to them to make sure they're getting enough quality protein. Because one of the problems with elite athletes is they're burning so many calories and they're tearing down muscle, and there's a higher level of turnover protein in the body. You have to have the essential amino acids to repair. And we also know that you need to have those essential amino acids prior to and following, probably most importantly, following exercise to really stimulate protein synthesis. And so it's just much harder to do as a vegetarian than somebody that would have a more plentiful and more varied, complete proteins in their diets, what they get from meat and fish and things like that.
It seems like there's been a lot of awareness in, the last 5 years or 10 years, and particularly the supplement companies are doing a pretty good job in getting protein out in the form of bars and shakes and things like that. Are we now at the point where the average well-looked-after athlete is getting enough protein, or are there some athletes maybe getting too much protein? How do you see things?
It depends on the type of athlete. I mean, if you're a power athlete, most of the time your diet's plenty in protein, and really what you focus on is maybe a protein drink or something to time the intake before and after the practice to really stimulate protein synthesis. On the other hand, if you're an endurance athlete, sometimes females, especially in events that are weight-bearing or aesthetic, that they're worried about body composition, how they look, sometimes they tend to cut things out of the diet that are good sources of protein, and their protein intake is relatively low in comparison to what their needs are. Generally, an athlete needs about twice the normal amount of protein than a non-athlete, sedentary non-athlete. And if most football players and power athletes, they'll get about 1.8 grams per kg. That's probably enough in time things. But a lot of endurance athletes and women who are high-level athletes often still have fairly low protein intake and actually can get protein malnourished. So we really emphasize quality protein and protein timing in those populations.
So what about in terms of the percentage of protein relative to the rest of the diet, percentage of fat, percentage of carbohydrate?
Well, for most athletes, if you have a normal amount of calories and you're burning per day, we're generally, 45 to 55% carbohydrate, more for endurance athletes, a little bit less probably for power athletes. Generally, the 15, 20% of protein. But what we really do is we don't focus much on the percentages because that all depends on your caloric intake. If you're having a low caloric intake, you're just cutting weight or something, you're going to need more protein and carbohydrate, less fat maybe. So what we really focus on is grams per kg per day. And so for protein needs, the general recommendations are about 1.4 to 1.8 grams per kilogram body weight per day. Well, that almost is like 1 gram for every 2 pounds that you weigh per day. And that's enough protein to meet your needs. And then timing nutrient intake is really what's exploded in sport nutrition over the last 10 years. It's not just having a good diet, it's when those nutrients are introduced before and after exercise in particular can make a big impact on your training adaptations. And so we teach the athlete after a good diet, make sure there's enough protein, make sure there's enough carbohydrate depending on your energy needs, and to time the nutrients to really optimize the training adaptation.
So are we talking about the window particularly after a workout?
Correct. So, for example, we know that you need a good diet, a sufficient carbohydrate, have the energy to be able to do the exercise. For most athletes that kind of, you know, work out an hour or two a day, that could be maybe 3 grams per kg, maybe five. If you're really doing 2 a days or really intense training, it may go up to even up to 8 or 10 grams per kg per day of carbohydrate. And the window of time is when you do the exercise, you're stimulating anabolic processes, you're promoting breakdown, and then after exercise, the body naturally responds with an anabolic response, a synthesis response. So you want to provide carbohydrates after exercise to resynthesize the burned carbohydrate. You want to provide amino acids right after exercise, and that's been shown to markedly stimulate protein synthesis. And we usually say, well, that's a good time to get your creatine as well, because we know if you ingest creatine with carbohydrate and protein, it stores quicker and better to the muscle. And so that post-exercise period is really important to optimize the training adaptation. It doesn't take a lot. We're only talking maybe, you know, a half a gram of protein per kg, maybe 30, 40 grams of protein for most people, and maybe 80, 100 grams of carbohydrate right after, within 30 minutes after exercise. And that's plenty to really stimulate the training adaptation.
Now, the only thing you didn't mention there were fats. Are they counterindicated in that post-exercise window?
Well, the challenge with fat is that the more fat you have in a meal or a supplement or something, the slower the digestion rate. And when you take in amino acids right after exercise, you want to stimulate protein synthesis. You want insulin to go high, so you want a simpler sugar to drive insulin up, and you want amino acids to really be available for synthesis. If I have fat with that meal, it slows down the digestion rate and thereby the stimulus of protein from these amino acids. And so we generally, this is one reason why convenience supplements and bars and things are really good for athletes, is because they can get the nutrients they need. Usually they're fairly low in fat. And then, you know, within an hour or two later, they could eat a normal meal that's, you know, balanced and higher in carbohydrate and lean, and then get all the things they need.
So sort of low fat before the workout and low fat immediately after the workout, and then maybe the rest of the day high fat.
Right.
Okay.
Back to the normal diet.
Can we go back to the sprint athletes and you know the bursty plyometric type athletes versus the endurance athletes?
Sure.
It sounds to me that it's a no-brainer if you're a sprint athlete, particularly a track sprinter, but really, you know, any kind of sprinting. But as you go further out, do you start, you know, in terms of time, steady state exercise, when does it look like it's not worth the hassle and expense, or is it always worth the hassle and expense of supplementing with creatine?
I think it's always worth the hassle, and the expense is so small that it's really something that should be incorporated in most athletes' diets. You can get right now a high-quality creatine, a kilo of creatine right now for maybe $25, $30, and that's enough to last 6 months or more for most athletes. You're talking now pennies, you know, six cents a teaspoon. So, you know, sometimes people worry about the supplements and expense. You know, it costs you a whole lot more to get that energy drink, you know, before and after, you know, fluid hydration. That may cost you $1.50, $2 per drink. You know, if you get some of these high energy type of drinks, it might be more. Creatine is very inexpensive. You know, it's basically about a penny, maybe 2 cents per teaspoon if you get the quality creatine. So it's almost like it's something that just should be incorporated into most athletes' diets if they're really serious about training. Just like eating higher carbohydrate and a low-fat diet and quality protein.
Certainly compared to the cost of a coffee latte, you could probably buy a heck of a lot of high-quality creatine, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm always amazed to go to the airport and people stand in line for, you know, 30 minutes to pay $5 for a cup of coffee. Whereas, you know, if you spend $5, you can get a really nice energy bar and probably a whole lot better. You can have enough creatine last probably 6 weeks with $5. So, it just depends on people's perceptions of what they think is expensive.
And what about risk of any you know, perception of taking performance, illegal performance enhancing drugs? How does that all fit into, you know, a generalized concern that anything that an athlete takes, you know, unless it's absolutely got the green light from every agency you can imagine, they should probably stay away from it. How do you address those concerns?
Well, there's always ethical concerns when you're talking about performance enhancement with athletes, but training is a technique for performance enhancement, different levels of coaching and quality coaching affects performance. And when we're talking about performance enhancement, we're trying to encourage people to train wisely and time nutrients properly. And so we're really focusing on natural and nutritional strategies to optimize performance. And one of the things from our point of view is if we have good nutritional strategies, it reduces the interest and need to think about other types of potentially dangerous drugs athletes may try. And so, you know, in the spectrum, some people say, well, anything that enhances performance shouldn't be done. Well, if that's the case, we can't even allow athletes to drink water.
Good point.
Certainly couldn't let them go to, you know, train at an altitude or anywhere because there's performance enhancement benefits from all these things. So, you know, I think there's degrees, and in our view, as long as it's a nutritional strategy, using good science, it's just like using good training techniques to try to optimize performance. You know, all coaches have a menu of how to train an athlete. Some will train them smart, some won't. Some will get more benefit out of the training because they're smarter. Same thing with their diet and nutrition. You have some coaches that, well, don't matter, we went to the Final Four eating, you know, chicken nuggets. It doesn't matter. And we have other coaches that are very serious about nutrition and try to optimize performance through nutrition. And so, you know, timing nutrients, carbohydrate, quality proteins in the diet, good diet, you know, teaching athletes what type of foods to eat before competition, during, and the basic supplements of carbohydrate and creatine and some protein really go a long way.
And the coaches who appreciate that, are there any particular varieties? Is it a generational thing? You know, what are the trends in terms of their receptivity to the kind of research and findings that you're presenting?
It's interesting because, you know, over the years we've talked to everybody from swimming coaches to football coaches, and we do a lot of, you know, I work a lot with the National Strength and Conditioning Association, and we have the spectrum of coaches. I think most of the newer coaches are better trained academically, that, you know, they go through programs like ours in kinesiology and learn exercise physiology and sport nutrition and, you know, strength conditioning. And so they typically apply the scientific applications of training, sport, and nutrition a little bit better. I've had a lot of older coaches, however, that are very up and very trying to stay on the cutting edge and picking your brain about what, you know, the latest we know about nutrition and performance. We also have a lot of what I call hand-me-down coaches, which are, you know, they're kind of trained apprentices. So whoever they train with, they kind of learn their techniques, and if they work, they figure it's pretty good. So they sometimes don't know all the best science behind it, but they know a lot of practical, tried, true techniques that have led to good performance. And I've worked with coaches that, you know, we sit down and we plan everything out the whole year to try to optimize and peak, prevent overtraining. And I've had other coaches that, you know, that stuff is fine, you know, it's okay, but to them it's not as important. Our experience is that the coaches that really focus on optimal training get the most out of their athletes. And it's easy to coach great athletes. It's harder to coach average athletes and make them great. And that's really where the art and science and coaching comes in, and where the real science and the sports science comes to play.
And, you know, there'd be the assumption that younger coaches would be more receptive, but is that necessarily the case?
I think probably most of the newer coaches, because they've gone through better academic training and becoming a coach in sports science, is a problem. That's probably true. But, like, again, I've got some coaches that, you know, one of the secrets is they're always up on the latest trends, and they're trying to pick people's brains. And, you know, Coach Hart, for example, is a good example. I was at Baylor. We sat down with him and the tennis coaches and football coaches and basketball coaches. We actually supported a lot of their teams there when I was there. And, you know, it just depends on the environment and the coaches. And everybody wants to win. So if they can find ways to get their athletes to perform better, and it's healthy for them, they usually are open to that. The other thing is, a lot of times these performance enhancement efforts come through strength and conditioning and through athletic training. And to become a, you know, certified strength and conditioning coach these days, you have to have a lot of training. Obviously, athletic training, you have to be certified. So more of the younger professionals are learning these techniques, learning this science, and they can recognize how best to treat and manage and train athletes.
Okay. I want to come back just briefly to this issue about endurance athletes. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe in an extreme example, but, you know, the classic time trialing in cycling, you know, say an hour of pretty much steady state the entire hour. Are you saying that even in that kind of situation where there isn't there are no bursts, there are no sprints, that creatine is useful?
Yeah, and it's because we're not only just talking about the acute performance. There's actually been studies on time trial and sprinting at the end, and the studies are kind of mixed on immediate performance. But here's the rationale for endurance athletes. We know that if you have your muscle loaded with creatine before you carbohydrate load, which almost all endurance marathon runners, triathletes all have to do, that you will store more carbohydrate in the muscle with higher creatine content in the muscle. So it's a way to more effectively carbohydrate load. We also know that by taking creatine, you can maintain muscle mass a little bit better during heavy training. A lot of endurance athletes are challenged to keep their muscle mass up as they go through a long season because they're training so much. And so there's also data in a few studies showing that it affects your anaerobic threshold, and that was basically the highest level of intensity you can maintain aerobically before you start building a lot of lactic acid up and going into anaerobic metabolism. And so for the endurance athlete trying to compete at the highest level of a time trial, they want to have the highest threshold possible that they can produce the most power output. And the other reason is that most endurance athletes now also weight train. And by taking creatine during training, you can get stronger and you can have recovery. So it makes running and carrying your body and doing all types of activity a little more efficient, more power output per amount of oxygen used. So there's a number of good reasons and studies showing that there may be benefit for the endurance athlete. Now, do we have as many studies showing that if you take it, you're going to run a faster marathon time? No. But we do know that if you take it and you're trying to carbohydrate, it has a bigger impact. So that should potentially lead to greater performance over time.
Now, I think you used the word at the beginning, ergogenic, which I think it would be useful to define. And also, if you could put that in the context of creatine versus, from what I understand, is classic ergogenic, very common substance in the form of caffeine, which obviously athletes take a lot of. So can you compare and contrast those two?
Well, ergogenic aid is basically any training technique, device, nutritional aid, psychological aid, that can improve the performance or the efficiency of exercise. So, for example, I think of a cyclist, a triathlete that uses triathlon bars, you know, and they're more aerodynamic. Well, that is a mechanical ergogenic aid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Better running shoes, for example, in runners, where you're able to do more miles and less discomfort. That's an ergogenic aid. Okay, so it can be different styles. When we talk about nutrition, we're really talking about nutritional strategies to improve performance or the capacity of performance or training adaptation. And that could be everything from, you know, basic carbohydrate loading to give more energy in the muscle, last longer during, you know, marathon, don't hit the wall as quick as soon into a marathon. Or can be a strategy to try to improve exercise capacity. Caffeine would be a pharmaceutical, a pharmacological ergogenic aid, because it's actually a drug. It comes in food, but it's actually a drug. And by taking caffeine, for example, drinking a cup or two of coffee, you know, getting 100 to 200 milligrams of caffeine before you exercise, it stimulates fat mobilization. We know it spares muscle carbohydrate use, and you're able to perform longer because you don't use as much of your carbohydrate as soon into exercise when you start. It also can affect mood and cognition and mental focus and those types of things. So that's an example of a common one that a lot of athletes will drink, you know, or energy drink, get some caffeine and or get some coffee or taking caffeine pills before they exercise to try to get that going. That's a pharmacological ergogenic aid. Another pharmacological ergogenic aid might be EPO doping. You hear a lot about that with Lance Armstrong. increasing red blood cell count. It's kind of like blood doping through this hormone that you take. In the old days, the blood dope, you'd have to take your own blood out, store it for, you know, 6 weeks, freeze it, and put it back into your body, and then you have more red blood cells and you perform aerobically better. So there's a lot of different types of ergogenic aids out there. And what we try to focus on is through good training, good nutrition to optimize performance.
And so you're saying caffeine has a part to play, but are there some counterindications, or, you know, are there problems with excess caffeine consumption from what you've seen?
There could be. You know, caffeine, most athletes will take caffeine before competition. It's probably works better for endurance athletes or for acute mental focus, like if you're tired and you need to be more alert. The negative potential would be could cause jitteriness. So if I'm trying to shoot, you know, or archery or shoot something, you know, I don't want caffeine to be nervous before I'm trying to relax. I want to relax as much as possible. So it depends on the sport. But, you know, for general motor skills, if you're heavily dependent on carbohydrate, it could give you, you know, extend your gas tank a little bit longer so you don't hit the wall like you do, you know, if you don't have a lot of carbohydrate in your diet. So it just depends on the application of a particular sport, what may be wise or not.
And now going back to the optimal time, you know, nutrient timing and so forth, what's your feeling, you know, with regard to caffeine consumption and also creatine and branched chain amino acids? There's some people looking at exercising in a fasted state, you know, with an empty stomach. To what extent is that advisable, or in what circumstances would that be a good idea, or if any?
Yeah, you know, some people try to be more fasted and exercise and thought is maybe you'll burn more fat. Problem is you also use a lot more protein. So there's pros and cons to it. If you're trying to build muscle, that's not smart. If you're just trying to promote fat loss, that might be a little bit more advantageous. What we tell athletes to do is you have a good diet, which is primarily a little bit higher in carbohydrate, quality protein, and low fat. And then you time nutrient intake. And before an event or training, you know, having a snack, you know, 30 minutes to 60 minutes before exercise, maybe half of an energy bar or some yogurt or something to get a little bit of carbs, a little bit of protein into your body. That can provide some amino acids during the exercise as well as some carbohydrate. Help fuel toward the end of the bout if it's a long bout of exercise. During exercise, it's lots of water and sports drinks primarily. You know, goos and these type of gels and things can also be helpful to get some carbohydrate, like for triathletes or marathon runners, these type of things. After exercise, we really focus on getting carbohydrate, protein, which includes some quality amino acids, and that's when we tell our athletes to take creatine once they've loaded, right after exercise. So we have our athletes leave, we try to get them to have an energy bar, an energy drink, something with carbs and some protein in it, and then they focus on eating, you know, within an hour or two after that. And then those basic things could really make an impact on training adaptations.
Now, I think I've seen something about taking branched chain amino acids in capsule form before a workout, with the idea that they would begin releasing during the workout or very shortly thereafter. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, we actually did studies on that back in the late 80s. It's kind of interesting how this stuff kind of goes and grows and develops. We know that if you have as little as 3 grams of essential amino acids, that this can make a big impact on protein synthesis. And the studies show that if you have a little bit of amino acids before and then right after exercise, the ones before kind of are helping spare muscle. Because your muscle can be broken down and those amino acids, if you exercise long enough, could be used for some fuel in addition to the carbohydrate in your muscle. And so you kind of have an anti-catabolic effect during exercise. And then after, the provision of those amino acids really stimulates protein synthesis. And I'm talking about 2-3 times normal rates by just having, you know, 3 to 6 grams of essential amino acids right after exercise. And so to optimize that training stimulus, we really focus on post-exercise nutrition. And it's usually an energy drink, a shake, a bar, something that, you know, you don't have to mix, you don't have to cook, but you can get into your body fairly quickly. It's convenient. and then you at least get some nutrients going to optimize the training of the patient.
Now, on these natural sources of creatine and protein and amino acids, where is there a place for organ meats from animals? And I'm also thinking about raw milk, which seems to be a bit of a trend at the moment.
Yeah, I haven't seen any specific to those, whether that's better or not. We know that most proteins are a little bit different in types of proteins, and certainly the physiological effect of protein can be impacted on how much fat's in it and other composition, how long it takes to digest. Usually you want simpler digested essential amino acids that stimulate protein synthesis right after. So we're usually looking at liquids or bars that can provide those things that can be digested easily. But then once your meal hits, you can do whatever you feel that's lean and high quality protein and good sources of carbohydrate.
And I know this is becoming a bit of a trend across not necessarily elite athletes, but sort of amateur athletes, and with one of the key centers being Austin, Texas, the paleo diet. I don't know how familiar you are with that, or generally speaking, the low-carb, ultimately high-fat type of approach to nutrient composition.
Yeah, there's different applications, in particular for diet. For athletes who really need lots of carbohydrate, it would be very difficult to perform well on a high-fat diet, low-carbohydrate diet. There actually are some studies that have been done that have done that with some populations and showed they were still able to perform fairly well. But to me, the data is just not strong enough to try to say that's something to do for an athlete. Now, if you're focusing on weight loss, which a lot of the average person is trying to lose weight, there is some potential benefit of higher protein, low-carb diets. We tend to recommend the lower-fat version, but there are some studies with higher fat content and high protein and low carbohydrate that also have some good effects on weight loss. Most of this type of diet depends on how the person responds. Some diets work better in some, not in others. We've done a lot of weight loss studies, especially in women in our research here, and the higher protein, lower fat, moderately low carbohydrate seems to do better than a standard high carbohydrate, low fat, low protein diet. And so we actually have worked with Curves and their group to develop a lot of diets and compare the different types of diets. So it just depends on the application. So, if you're trying to promote body composition, weight loss, maybe there's some application. If you're a high-end athlete, I would stay away from it.
All right. Well, last question on creatine. Are there any particular cofactors, any other nutrients that should ideally be consumed alongside creatine? I'm guessing vitamin C or obviously you mentioned protein and the constituent components of protein, but what else might people consider if they're taking creatine?
Yeah, we know creatine by itself can work. If you mix it with a higher carbohydrate drink, a concentrated carbohydrate drink or juice, seems to have more retention to muscle. It also has the same thing if you drink it with a carbohydrate protein drink or shake or something, also seems to work very well. There actually have been studies where they've combined creatine with other potential nutritional ergogenic aids and found some synergistic and additive benefits. For example, some studies show that if you combine creatine with HMB, which is kind of an anti-catabolic leucine derivative. HMB. That might have some benefit. There's been studies where they combine it with, we actually did one study where you combine it with beta-alanine, which is also another very popular dietary supplement now. That seems to have a little bit of synergistic effect in some of the studies. So a lot of the studies are not just one. They're trying to mix several things the body needs and provide them at the right time to enhance the adaptation. So for our athlete, athletes that we work with, it's providing a good diet and then timing nutrients, and then the very few ergogenic aids that we think about for the power athlete is creatine. If you do a lot of high-intensity aerobic stuff, maybe sodium phosphate, caffeine can also help in addition to regular carbohydrate and drinks. So there are really only a few things the studies have consistently seen to really make an impact.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating and hugely helpful. Now, if there are coaches who want to learn more about this topic and see what you've done, which resources would you point them toward, either online or sure. paper format?
Yeah, we have a very comprehensive website. It's called exerciseandsportnutritionlab.com. Exerciseandsportnutritionlab.com. We have a lot of free articles and PowerPoints on nutritional guidelines for athletes. A lot of our research articles are on there. And then we have developed a book a few years ago on exercise and sport nutrition. And what's neat about that, there's training programs and there's what to do before exercise, during exercise, depending on the type of athlete you are, and a lot of performance enhancing training things in there that's written for the layperson, not just the scientist out there. And that you can get on exerciseandsportnutrition.com.
That's great. And we'll put the details on the notes for the show on the website. Well, fantastic, Rick. Hugely appreciate your insight on this topic.
That's all for now. If you'd like further information, our website is sportscoachradio.com.